hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. And, of course, we do welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please don't call in unless we do request calls, because we have with us on the line from the ARC Institute, Jerry Guidetti. Hi, Jerry. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Dr. Stan. How about yourself?
Oh, doing fine. It's a beautiful time of year. You know, it's we are so blessed to live here in California. Have you got any snow up there in Oregon yet?
No, not at all. I'm down close to the coast. We don't get virtually any snow at all, and we don't even get freezes here because of the moderation by the Pacific Ocean. So it's really nice. When it's not raining out and when the wind is not severe in the wintertime, which it can often be in southern Oregon, it is spectacular weather. And I do usually get out to take a walk every single day. It's really quite nice.
Well, it's a nice place to live. Well, anyway, tell us what is happening in the world.
Well, certainly folks have been noticing that the dialogue is increasing. It's almost a scream at this point with respect to avian influenza around the world. It has certainly expanded across Asia. It's in the Ukraine. The mutations that have occurred in the Ukraine, unfortunately, have pointed to the most threatening to human beings variety or serotype of the H5N1 virus. We keep hoping and hoping, Stan, as I'm sure you do, hoping and praying that this thing is going to mutate back into birds where it belongs. But it doesn't show signs of doing that. It shows signs of doing just the opposite. It looks like we have it in Libya. We've got official documents that it is present in Libya. And certainly the doctor coming out of China this week into Hong Kong, a well-renowned physician over there, has proclaimed that China has it, in his words, in every corner, and that it is in humans as well as in birds, and that he has the evidence to prove it, that from physicians in China he was able to get human samples. And so that was quite an earth-shattering announcement this week, and folks have gotten much more concerned in official capacities. You'll probably remember that this week there were several specials on Sunday. One, the one by National Geographic Channel, if you haven't seen it. Folks should try to see the replays. I think it probably is the most accurate representation of what life would be like if this thing arrives this year in the United States.
Well, now, of course, how many people have actually contracted it recently in China? Do we have any idea?
Okay, in China, we don't have any real idea. They, of course, will only admit to World Health Organization of five that have come down with it. However, those numbers are entirely unreliable because they have admitted themselves that their limitations are the sampling, the doctors not recognizing it because they just don't have the staff or the testing facilities.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Jerry Guidetti to bring us up to date on the avian flu. All right, Jerry, pick up the story there.
Sure. We now have worldwide confirmed by World Health Organization, 70, just reached 70 yesterday, five-year-old boy died. It still is over 50% fatality, and that, of course, can change at any time. If we were to have a really accurate representation of how many people are walking around with this thing, we might say that the fatality rate is dropping. But without that knowledge of how many people really have it, we have to go with the numbers that have been actually sampled and proven in a laboratory are positives. We have tons of false negatives, and the false negatives are because in order to take a throat swab, the virus has to still be in the throat. And by the time these poor folks get brought into hospitals in Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, and China, for example, the organism has already left their throat. The virus has left their throat. It's gone down into the lungs, and it's no longer there. It turns out that people die, and then they find out after the fact that it was H5N1 after all. It just wasn't in the swab that they had taken. And the other trend that we have seen in the past 2 weeks has been the sizes of the clusters. If you watched either of the specials on Sunday, these folks visited the familial clusters, and we have families as large as five now who have been infected. So the question is, were they all exposed through the air surrounding or inside their homes where you had one infected individual? Were they all exposed in the air to particles that come from chicken dust out in the street, you know, contaminated with feces? Or did it come through the air from a neighboring chickens in the backyard? Or did it come from the family member with whom one is living?
Now, of course, the thing that everybody fears is human-to-human transmission. That is, of course, this is where you get into problems. If it's coming from the birds, why, it's unfortunate. But human-to-human transmission is the one great fear.
Right, and we already have human-to-human that is already proven. The only thing we're lacking yet definitive proof of is efficient human-to-human, so efficient that it spreads like the regular common cold or the regular influenza that people are used to being exposed to every year, regular type A influenza or human influenza. And when that occurs, which may already have occurred, we just don't know for sure, but when that occurs, then it's only a very short time before it reaches all the way around the world, and the birds will be inconsequential or nearly.
Hold that off right there, Jerry, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Jerry Guidetti is from the ARC Institute, who's actually spent a great deal of time in genetic engineering at the university level, but now, of course, she's been studying what's happening as far as the avian flu epidemic is concerned, and points out that certainly to date, we have no evidence that it's readily spread from person to person. It's certainly decimating the birds. We're talking about 150 million birds either killed or having died from this, somewhere in that neighborhood. And certainly it seems to be spreading widely throughout the birds. And it is certainly in some instances getting into human beings. Is it yet to the point where it will spread readily from person to person, or are the people who are getting it primarily from the birds, or does it spread from person to person but with great difficulty? The one thing about influenza, and the reason it can be so deadly, is because influenza itself is so highly contagious, and in normal form, once it begins spreading from person to person, it can, as Jerry says, can go around the world in a very short period of time. So right now, I think everybody's waiting to see what the latest results are out of China, and then, of course, as this begins moving down to the birds on into Africa. So pick up the story there, Jerry.
Sure. It has already apparently gone into Africa, and they're still talking about it being a low pathogenic variety there. There, of course, all bets are off. Once it goes into Africa, you have just so many chickens out and wild birds everywhere, and in it goes into those animals, and they live closely also with their animals, the humans do, and you get all of these mutations, and they mutate very well in pigs and so on. And it's also in the Middle East, and right now in Saudi Arabia, they are taking extraordinary precautions to prevent an outbreak of bird flu at the annual Hajj or the pilgrimage to Mecca, where, my gosh, if you've ever seen any of those pictures, it's a massive, massive number of people all pressed together in the same area, and they are coming from Muslim countries that have bird flu. And it's unfortunate, but it's appearing like this would be the ideal setting for a human-to-human mutation or transfer to take place. And so you have these holidays coming up with the Christian holidays, and then you have Muslim holidays and so on. All of these are coming up at a time when people are traveling great distances and potentially taking this virus with them. We do know, Stan, for example, that the virus is getting weaker, which would normally be good news. But unfortunately with influenza, as you are aware as a physician, getting weaker is not necessarily a good thing, because it allows the virus then the ability to spread farther and farther because an individual is able to walk around. It's called the ambulatory ill. They're walking about infected. They're infecting many other people, and they're not necessarily getting deathly ill themselves, but because they're spreading it to so many others. Eventually, with the population of the earth, the numbers of deaths are still going to be massive. And so we already have this. There was a little boy who was interviewed, a 9-year-old boy, a really sharp little fellow, who caught it in his household where he sat next to an aunt. The aunt died. He didn't live there. He visited. He had no exposure directly to chickens in that house or anything. Now they think, and this is something to think about, they think the ant may have had it or gotten it from chicken fertilizer for her plants. She grows potted plants. And the chicken manure fertilizer, well, many of us used to use anyway chicken manure, but we generally like to use sterile manure preparations. And I have, you know, folks have called the Ark Institute for years and have asked, Jerry, you know, do you believe in using manure? I used manure for my organic gardening, my seed gardening, too. I used it just for 30 years. But because of the mutation of bacteria and because of viruses, I have not been recommending any raw manure be used in gardening now for quite a few years because of the E. coli, the enterohemorrhagic E. coli, and so on that's present in manures. Nature is definitely out of balance. And I always recommend now that folks not handle raw manure in any way, shape, or form. This year may be even more critical, and for the next few years, because any of the bird manures and droppings in the field and so on may be highly contagious. And so we recommend that folks not use raw manure if you're going to use manure to spend the money and buy the sterilized bags of manure that you can buy in nurseries and so on, and just not do it. And no, composting doesn't kill all of the bacteria reliably. It could if you heated up the compost pile and ran very good, efficient compost piles, turning them, keeping it oxygenated, getting the heat up and so on. That will kill off the bacteria. But most backyard gardeners are rather casual about manure piles, and so we're not recommending, the Ark Institute isn't recommending using manures, especially this year. So this woman apparently got it from manure. That's what they're looking at now. It's the only thing that was positive, H5N1 positive, in her entire environment, and it was her potted plants. So it's something to think about. Now, her nephew got it, and this was Thailand, and her nephew got it, and he had a milder case. He has returned to school. That could be good news and bad news. As I say, we're waiting for that milder mutation. As you know, Stan, the things like Ebola, for example, are not very good organisms for decimating the earth, as influenza is. And the reason is they are such effective killers that they take down their victim so quickly, and the victim dies so rapidly that they don't have a chance, and they get so sick so fast, they don't have a chance to carry it around to all the friends, neighbors, on the airplane, and so on. Whereas influenza, especially a weaker influenza, does. But right now, this baby is killing 51 to 52%. 1918, by comparison, killed 2.6%. So we're looking at something with the potential, which is what's scaring all of us half to death. We're looking at something but the potential to set the human race back 200 years easily, and none of us want to think that that's possible. So we're all speaking out in our separate areas of expertise and asking folks to do something that humans have never had the opportunity to do before, and that is to actually recognize that it's coming. We don't know if it's this week or this month or next month, or next year. But it is coming. We've had 10 pandemics in 300 years. This is a regular event. This isn't a conspired event. This is a regular event that happens on the earth. And recognize that it's coming, and for the first time, be able to actually work to protect yourself, to prepare and to recognize what impact it's likely to have in these modern times on your ability to survive and your families and loved ones' ability to survive. So we are each, again, focusing in our areas of expertise, and I would love to be able to, with your audiences, Stan, talk about the fact that Dr. Osterholm and many of the epidemiologists are starting to focus on the critical needs, the critical supplies that everyone is going to need that most people don't recognize exists in our modern society. For example, pharmaceuticals, your everyday diabetes medications, high blood pressure, cancer chemotherapy drugs, and so on. In the United States, most people don't know this, but 80% of all of the raw materials needed to make the drugs we need to live in this modern society are imported from overseas. Now, that's mind-boggling, because having to be imported at a time when everyone is assuring us that when a pandemic strain arises, it could happen tomorrow morning, it could happen 2 years from now, but it will eventually arise. And when it does, global trade is expected to slow down to the point where it's totally ineffective and eventually stops.
Well, I think the thing, Jerry, is that people should have certainly good supplies of pharmaceuticals and vitamins and the various things that they really would need if there were a pandemic or some other type of disruption of our society. And the fact that we see today this marked increase in the price of gold and silver just over this last couple of weeks, as we talked on another program, certainly that when you begin to see the price of gold up, it's like going up as rapidly as it is, it's like the canary in the mine shaft. And the canary tells you when there's something seriously wrong when you're down in the mine. And when the canary drops over, why, you really want to get out of that mine. In the same manner, when you watch the price of gold and you begin to see it going up without any good logical explanation, something major is afoot in our society. Would you agree?
I think you're absolutely correct, and I think that's very astute observation, because I have watched the price of gold too, and I've watched it for a long time. I actually did get some because I felt that in a situation, in a global situation, where whole economies are going to collapse because these things, these pandemics last anywhere from 12 to 18 months because of the waves that come through and so on. In that kind of situation, we can't depend upon life as usual. Now, many of us believe that the price of gold is actually a signal that the smart money is retreating to a safe storage of value at a time when the global economy may collapse. And I think you're right, Stan. I think we're seeing part of that gold price is preparation for this uncertainty.
And of course, remember the canary in the mine shaft. Well, of course, the price of gold is rising unexplainably at a rate I have never seen, at least not going back to 1980. Just keep an eye on it. Realize, of course, this means that the smart people are expecting some major cataclysmic event, whether it be war, whether it be a pandemic, as Jerry is suggesting, whatever it may be, begin making preparations. Okay, Jerry, pick up the story there.
Sure. What we would like to recommend, and from, you know, from my perspective, and we have at the ARC Institute always discussed global food supply issues, genetic modification of seeds, and why that's important to us. And the reason it's important to us is because we saw years ago, I personally saw in genetic engineering, the potential not only for good, but the potential for evil, and that is the removal out of the hands of individuals and even whole cultures, the ability to raise their own food and feed their own families. It's taking away from man the God-given right to raise your own food, because by crippling seeds with many of these techniques that are designed to do just that, people are losing the ability to feed themselves. So I look at the potential for a pandemic as being yet one more death knell to the ability to for people to feed themselves. And so we've always recommended that people retain their right and the ability to raise even a small amount of their own food, and whatever seed, whatever things that they cannot personally raise, that they encourage others to raise them too. And so what we're suggesting, taking a look at Dr. Osterholm's presentation before the Senate last week, before the Congress rather, last week, both houses, he was talking about the disappearance of food from grocery stores, and he was talking about the very severe shortages that are expected with pandemic. Well, taking that a step further, today the word came out that U.S. officials are now saying that oil, high prices of oil, are here to stay. Now, when I hear that, I'm not just thinking about my tank of gas. I hear it again as a food story, because every single aspect of commercial agriculture that we depend upon to put all of our food in our mouths, most of us, that is 100% dependent upon oil and natural gas, from the giant combines that have to run on diesel and gasoline, to all of the equipment that is used to separate the wheat seed from the chaff, to the fertilizers that are made out of natural gas, to the pesticides and herbicides that commercial agriculture requires in order to get these huge monoculture crops out of the ground and with reasonable size vegetables on them and so on. All of this stand can collapse in the course of one season, as much as nobody likes to think about those things. And we're looking at a pandemic that is going to come, on average, say that you have the first wave, it will last anywhere from 8 weeks to 12 weeks for that wave to go through. So we're looking at months for the first wave to go through. Then there will be 8 to 20 weeks of no pandemic. We will have a chance to bury our dead. We can start mourning the loss of our loved ones and so on. Just when you think things are okay, life will go on, the next wave comes through. The second is usually worse than the first, because more people get it. Even if the death rate has gone down, more people get it. Again, it lasts for 2 to 3 months. This goes on and on at least three times.
That's all right, hold up off right there, Jerry. We want to bring our other stations back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Jerry was saying that certainly the rise in the price of oil and petroleum products is going to have a profound effect on the availability of food. And she, of course, is very concerned about the stability of our food supply, mainly because so many of the very seeds are being genetically altered. But even more than that, with the rising price of oil, it's going to make farming extremely expensive. Certainly, diesel is used by our tractors and our combines, and for the harvesting and for the planting of our products. And then the fertilizers and the chemicals that are used in farming are totally dependent upon on the price of petroleum. And we have heard rumors from farmers across America that many of the banks are saying, look, you're not going to be able to make a profit this year with a fixed agricultural products price, large overhang we have from last year. Why, the banks are simply not going to lend, at least to farmers in certain areas, and we have farmers out there across America would like to know if you're going to be able to get financing from your local banks. But if the banks aren't going to loan to the farmers because they don't think there's enough profit to be made, and they're not going to be able to make it with the rising price of oil and petroleum products, then how is that going to impact on the harvest that would come in next year? So these are all things certainly to be thinking about. Go ahead, Jerry.
Right. And so when you add that to the situation with pandemic influenza, and the fact that I was just talking about the waves of influenza coming through, to kind of give you this idea of this timeline. The timeline of any pandemic that lasts anywhere from 12 months to 18, the most severe part of the pandemic, Some argue that it can go 3 or 4 years. They think 1918 may have gone all the way out to 20, and maybe it began in 1915, 16, when they had the first waves going through, when they didn't understand the avian part of it, which is what we're trying to get a handle on now. So if you take the already serious situation with oil prices, and that supplies are not going to increase in the foreseeable future, that in fact we are reaching peak in terms of our supplies of oil and being the foundation of all of our agriculture, and now layer pandemic on top of that, you can soon see that you are looking at the potential for the loss of one, maybe two seasons of agriculture that we depend in modern society 100% on. Now, who's going to be better off? Is it going to be the 1.3 billion people in the world who are completely self-sufficient farmers? Granted, they're a lot leaner and hungrier than we are, but perhaps, given they still own their own seeds, the non-hybrids, the non-genetically engineered seeds, they at least will have the potential to come back. What we have been asking people to do is face the reality that whether they do it this year or next or the following in the grips of a pandemic, that they may be called upon to survive using their own resources, including their own seeds. And it was gratifying to me to find in part of the Department of Health and Human Services plans and other plans starting to emerge that the preparation lists include non-hybrid seeds on them, and for good reason, because, you know, you've got the top speaker in the world on pandemic flu on the national and international stage is now Dr. Osterholm, and who also works with the Department of Homeland Security and so on for protecting our food supply. Now, you've got him out there saying that food supplies will be severely limited. He said, we can now tell you, and I'm going to paraphrase because this quote's not sitting in front of me, but it is very close to exactly what he said. We can now tell you with certainty that for 12 to 18 months, you will be stressed watching your loved ones die. I mean, this is a conservative person talking like this. Watching your loved ones die, wondering how or if you're going to have food for the next day. And then third, he said, and for this reason, we are needing to prepare now in this country in a way that we haven't had to prepare for over 80 years for any event. And that would mean most people alive today can't even think about this kind of catastrophe, which is the word everyone's using. So we're asking folks to take that seriously and plan this year to learn how to do, even in pots, and I want to help you with that, how to raise some of their own food to minimize suffering.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment. Our guest has been Jerry Quidetti, of course, who does support Radio Liberty and helps us bring these programs to you. And I think that there is the potential for some very, very real problems in America. And our plea is to make preparations for all sorts of eventualities. But, of course, if there were to be any interruption in the normal supplies to our grocery stores, how would you survive? We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jerry Guidetti. And, Jerry, go ahead. Of course, you were saying that you were encouraging people to begin making those preparations, and specifically, of course, to be beginning making preparations so that they would be able to grow some food on their own. Go ahead.
Sure. What we would recommend is that you do things that even, let's say, you live the next 10 years and we are blessed and we don't see a pandemic for 10 years. I don't think we're going to see that. There's still a very good chance we're going to get it this winter to spring, and it doesn't stop in the summertime, by the way. If it goes human to human, it may very well be even around then. But at any rate, what we would suggest you do is you pick up things that are excellent investments anyway, even if you never saw a pandemic, and that would be things like bags of potting soil, and I'm thinking of people who might have apartments now and not have backyards and not have a farm and so on. You live in the suburbs, you don't have a lot of spare soil around. As your budget can afford, start picking up large bags of potting soil. And keep in mind that if they are not fertilized already with, say, a 3-month fertilizer in them, and most organic ones are not fertilized with 3 months fertilizer in them, then make sure that you pick up some fertilizer as well, some good healthy fertilizer, something that's meant for food consumption. And you can find these things in almost any home store, the Home Depots and Lowe's and those kinds of places, and in nurseries and so on. Pick those up now. Start accumulating them. Don't forget to grow tomatoes. In the wintertime, you want to start your seeds, and in most places in the country, you'd be wanting to start them late February to middle of March. So now is the time to be thinking about that and accumulating these assets, these resources. Start saving milk containers if you don't have the budget for lots of flats and pots and things like that. Start saving milk containers that you can cut off and make into planters. Save yogurt cups. Those make great ones. Or big packages in the cheap stores. Big packages of styrofoam cups or other plastic cups. They make fantastic planters. And then plan on trays, for example, that you can raise seedlings for, say, lettuce and things like that, that you can get hundreds into one long tray. We recommend a book that the Ark Institute carries called Seed, Sowing, and Saving, and it's exactly that. It shows you how to simply sow seeds in all different kinds of containers you can grow them in.
Hold that thought there for just a moment, Jerry, and we'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Jerry's just been talking about the things that you could do as far as growing things are concerned. The things that you really would want to think about getting now would be things like having potting soil. And, of course, if you have the little trays that you can grow things in, if not, you can use styrofoam cups, or you can use certainly milk cartons, and you punch a little hole in the bottom and you so that the water can drain out. You can grow things in all sorts of things, at least temporarily, until they get larger, and then, of course, you'd like to get them in the ground, but you could actually even grow them in containers, can't you?
Oh, yes, you certainly can. As a matter of fact, if you don't have a backyard and you just have a little patio, for example, off your apartment, you can literally put tall pots or the bags themselves. I remember, for example, there was a group down in Arizona that was teaching folks who had very, very limited assets to grow whole crops in paper grocery store bags, the regular brown square bags, by filling these up with soil and going ahead and wetting them down, and the bags stayed together long enough to take you through a crop. And the bag leaked very well so that they didn't get overly watered, and you could easily poke holes in it and so on. And they did a bang-up job, and people were lining these things on their patios and on decks and things like that, even out on porches and sidewalks in communities where things like that wouldn't disappear. And they were doing a really good job. You can grow. If you want to grow things, you can find places to grow them. And the other thing we've suggested is you could get the bags themselves, the plastic bags that soil comes in. You can stand them up, one up against the other, and with a big fat meat fork like you use for cutting a turkey roast, you get one of those meat forks and you plunge it through many places in the bottom so that you assure that the water can run out of the bag, and you stand these babies up and you plant big plants like a tomato plant into the top of this bag after you slit it open. And you water from the top, and the roots go straight down, and here you've got maybe 2 to 3 feet of soil that the roots can crawl down in. And when you pile these bags one up against the other, keeps the roots kind of cool so that they don't bake in the sun and so on. And it makes another alternative if you don't have an actual garden space outdoors. The other thing you can look at doing is joining a community garden, and you can usually rent a plot for only $10 from the USDA's Extension Service, the County Extension Service, and you can get folks to actually rototill them up for you and everything in the spring. And if you live in a nice community, a community garden plot is something that all neighbors can join together and do, and so on. Now, in a pandemic...
First of all, before we go on, let's get your telephone number
and
your website out so people will know how to get in touch with you.
Sure. The phone number is 1-800-255-1912. 1-800-255-1912. And the website is ARC, A-R-K, as in Build Your ARC, arkinstitute.com, A-R-K-I-N-S-T-I-T-U-T-E.com. And go there, and not only will you find information on all of the gardening books and so on, there are buttons you can click on for gardening books and seeds and the whole business, but also there are all of the links and pages to the free information on preparations for the pandemic, on taking care of loved ones at home. Dr. Grattan Woodson's book is there. Another doctor's book is there. All of these things can be had just by clicking through. We would recommend you do that and you take it seriously and then begin accumulating these supplies, not next month, but begin accumulating them right now. Plan on planting them perhaps in a month or two, depending on where you are in the country. But start accumulating them now, because let me tell you what's happening. Levitt, what's his first name? You're going to help me here, Stan. I've suddenly blanked on Secretary Levitt. He is going to be going around the country to every state in the next 120 days. This is Department of Health and Human Services. It is a 50-state saturation tour, going to the states and telling them, get prepared, to tell them basically what their jobs are to do, how they must get their states motivated, they must get their communities planned, because essentially the message is there will be no federal solution to this. There will be not enough Tamiflu. There will not be a vaccine. If this thing hits in the next year, 2 years, even 3 years, there's not going to be enough of anything to have any kind of pharmaceutical solution. And so the word is going to go out to your communities, first from your state in the next 120 days, that your state has to get their acts together to protect you, to get hospitals going, and so on. There's not going to be time for them to talk about, you better get seeds, you'd better be able to feed yourselves for a while, because this thing might last 18 months or so. So when that word finally gets out, we're going to be at a panic level. And when the panic level happens, you're not going to be able to get much of anything. So I would really strongly recommend that you go ahead and click on the ARC, ARK Institute's website, or you go to your local store, and you'll also get a hold of some of these books we've been telling you about, that you can find online here, and get a hold of these things now. Make your plans now from these books and using pencil and paper, and plan where you can put in sunny locations, south side of your house. In the summertime, the sun goes further over to the north, so you may get really good sun over on north side of your house. If you've got them in pots, you should be, or bags, you should be able to move things to the right locations. And start planting these now. You want to grow lots and lots of green things. For example, lettuces, spinach, beets, anything with dark color. You're going to survive longer. You're going to be healthier. Dark color, carrots, beets, spinach, dark leafy lettuces, cabbage, broccoli. These are the things that can sustain life. Tomatoes, of course. You can grow hundreds of pounds of tomatoes on a couple of plants.
Well, Jerry, what about the things like Miracle-Gro and other things like that? Are they significant? Do they really help you to get a better crop and get more blossoms and more fruit?
The chemical things. Now, I'm an organic gardener.
Okay.
So I'm going to incur wrath of anybody. Now, the chemical things, of course, work, but they burn themselves out very quickly. They are not long sustained in the soil. You'd have to keep applying them, and where do they come from? They come from the same oil-type supplies and gas supplies, natural gas supplies, that are going to be running low. Not only is price and low supply naturally a problem, but in a pandemic, they're going to shut down the borders for delivery.
Well, then what would we use?
So what we would recommend is you get, there are organic pellets now, and basically they have a large portion of alfalfa meal in them. As a matter of fact, if you were to go to a farm store and get a bag of alfalfa pellets for cattle or sheep, you would have a very high protein fertilizer, at least on the protein end of it, in a bag like that. And so you'll have high nitrogen, which will give you a lot of green growth. You want balanced fertilizers, so you want to look for balanced organic fertilizers in your store. And something that has long-lasting ability and something that you could afford to buy enough of to take you through a couple of seasons, because this thing is going to last for a while. In the meantime, in your garden area, begin to accumulate all of the compostables, the outside leaves of the lettuce and the cabbage and the chopped up corn plants and tomato plants and so on. All of these things should be composted so that come a year from now, when you're running out of fertilizer, you've got nature's own. You've got your own organic fertilizer to dig into the soil. You could even do, an old farmer I used to work with used to go out, he was in his late 70s, and he would go out with each night's scrap from the kitchen table, and he used to take a shovel, and he'd dig down approximately 1 foot, and he'd just throw the lettuce leaves, tomatoes, whatever, into the trench next to his plants. And then the following year, his plants would be planted in that trench where that trench was. And they'd have all the compostables right there.
Well, now, if you have a compost pile, should you actually put some sort of a tarp over that to actually heat that up?
No.
Would that help the degeneration there?
No. As a matter of fact, you want it oxygenated. If you were to put a tarp over it, and this was a wet pile, you would be encouraging anaerobic respiration instead of aerobic.
Right.
And pretty soon it would smell like dead bodies. It would smell horrible, putrefied. You don't want that. What you want is aerobic. So what you want to do is you want to keep it moist. If you've got a hot burning sun out there, you could throw a bit of plastic over the top to minimize the evaporation of moisture from the pile. The pile really should be moist, but not soaking wet. And then every now and then you should rotate it. You should toss it with a fork. Or a simple way would, I can tell you lots of simple ways, but one simple way would be to take a perforated piece of polyethylene pipe and put it in the middle of your pile, through the middle of your pile, and build the pile over it. And the air coming into that pipe sticking out on either end is going to bring air into the middle of the pile. Of course, then it's not easy to turn it with the pipe in it. You'd have to turn it around it. The other thing you can do, and I've done this for years in the very dry West, you take just a small circle of chicken wire or a fencing wire, or your farm fencing wire, and you make a cylinder. You put that in a, say, in the center of a circle that's about 5 foot in diameter. You use that. Say it's about a foot and a half in diameter. You throw all your compostables in the middle of that column. You plant your plants in a circle around it. You can then focus your watering through the center of that cylinder, and you put all of your compostables into that cylinder, and over the course of the summer, as the compostables break down, they're feeding the roots of the plants that you've planted around it. That is one way to very simply compost in place the materials that are going to help feed the plants.
Okay, we've got Roger calling from Henderson, Nevada. Roger, do you have a question for Jerry?
Yes, I do. Jerry, would chromial silver, would that help you against the avian flu?
Okay, I have recommended just forever that no one take colloidal silver into their bodies. I mean, it's a difference, Roger. If you're dying, you're going to grasp at anything. But as you're probably aware, there's a very severe illness that arose from older people, pre-Y2K, and health-conscious people in general taking colloidal silver, and they now have in their flesh, in every organ of their body, silver, so that they are exceedingly gray people. They're almost silver. I ran into a woman at the mall who had it. It's a very terrible thing. There is no way, I have read of no way to chelate it out of the body again. It is toxic in quantities like that throughout your tissues. As I said, people who are dying of a disease, God bless you, do anything you need to do to attempt to save your life that you want to do, but I would never recommend it. Colloidal silver, just as the medical profession would tell you, silver used as a topical antimicrobial is probably a good idea. They used to put drops of it in babies' eyes, silver nitrate solution, to kill bacteria in babies' eyes. For wounds, you can put silver in wounds, and, you know, again, topical. But I personally don't recommend anyone take silver in those concentrations into their body. And
Jerry, Roger, I think that Jerry's absolutely right. I second what she's saying, and I know an awful lot of material out there. I've asked to see the scientific material. They'll send it to me. Tells me what a wonderful bactericidal agent it is, but
yes,
it's always topical, and all of these studies are topical. And you ask, where are the studies when they take it in? Well, we've got them, but they never show them to you. So just be very wary. I think they're going to poison an awful lot of people.
Right. As a matter of fact, heavy metals tend to disrupt DNA molecules and a lot of other molecules.
Yeah, why would you want to take a heavy metal and put it in your body?
Yes.
So anything else, Roger?
Yeah, one more question. I haven't heard about Immunotech products. They're made up of Canada. It helps deal with their glutathione levels. Have you ever heard of that?
What is the name of the Immunotech, you said?
Yeah, Immunotech Research. It's out of Canada. Okay, they have it. It's called Immunical. It's like a granulated substance powder, and you put it like with milk or with water.
Yeah, well, if you don't know, is it about a glycoprotein or some sort of glyconutrient?
Yes, it is, Dr. Stan.
I think that there are a lot of other things that certainly are equally good, like oil of oregano and certainly the garlic products. And certainly you want to have vitamin C and vitamin D and selenium and zinc around. There is certainly an element of a benefit in that, but there are lots of other things that are nowhere near as expensive that will act just as well.
Right, and one thing to keep in mind, Roger, and this is a thing that has perplexed us all and depresses us all at the same time. In 1918, most of the people who died, or a very large portion of people who died, were young people, especially like the military. They were struck down in the prime of their lives, and also children. Unfortunately, this one is proving to be the same thing. H5N1 is loving to kill young people, and the reason is that it takes the healthiest of immune systems, and it causes them to release the largest numbers, because they're so healthy, of these immune response chemicals called cytokines. And they come out in large numbers, and they accumulate massive amounts of proteins and blood and so on in the lung tissue. And so having any degree of great health is still no assurance that you're going to be able to survive this thing, and that's so very sad. Here's the good thing about being very healthy before a pandemic is that maybe, with God's grace, you're going to be able to resist the virus, and you're not going to come down sick to begin with. But if it gets a hold of you, the very young people who are getting more severely ill than the elderly are, and that's unfortunate, but it is the way the one worked in 1918. I do believe, and an awful lot of epidemiologists and other microbiologists believe, that the key to this one is to prevent yourself from getting sick, period.
And Roger, I would say that certainly there are a lot of products out there that will help your immunity, but right now they're all jumping on board, saying buy ours. Of course, they're all very, very expensive. I would get the things that are the least expensive that really work. So I've seen all these things for glyconutrients. A lot of them are multi-level marketing schemes.
Yes.
And, of course, so you're going to put all your money into that instead of all the things you really need to be getting. But certainly these things work. But they don't work any better than a lot of other immune system boosters. Hey, thanks so much for calling, Roger.
Yep, thanks so much. God bless you both. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Night-night.
And, Jerry, let's get your telephone number out one more time.
1-800-255-1912, arcinstitute.com.
And, of course, you're going to find a lot of information up there. Just free books, free information to tell you how to begin to prepare. Well, Jerry, we got 3 minutes to wrap up tonight's program. Go ahead.
Okay. Again, we would like all to believe that we aren't going to have any cataclysmic events here in the United States, and yet Katrina has shown us that these things do happen. This isn't hype. Pandemics have happened, will happen again, approximately three every century. And we're looking at one, a more likely one, in this H5N1. So we would ask folks to try to set themselves up that they will not only not be exposed, because they have the ability to self-quarantine, as your government's going to be suggesting you do, but be able to do it anyway, even if your government doesn't. Self-quarantine, it's the only real protection against exposure to it. And then the other thing is, to prevent collateral deaths. So many people died, families lost members, because they died of bacterial infections afterwards, or starvation, or thirst because there wasn't enough water available. Prevent collateral deaths now by preparing yourself to be indoors for long periods of time without help or assistance from governments, without having to go out for food and medications and so on. Take it seriously, because if this thing happens, even within the next year, we are grossly unprepared in this country. You're not going to have doctors in hospitals, they tell us. You're not going to have help. So get a hold of the free book on the Internet, on our website. Get Dr. Grattan Woodson's book, his manual. Download it right off our website, free of charge. Print it out. It's about 34 pages long. Make copies of it. Give it to your neighbors and friends who don't have computers. Start planning today, because you're going to be hearing more and more about it. And as people hear about it and panic sets in, if this thing goes in this next year, people are going to panic. And there aren't going to be supplies. So be wise. Invest now. It's not wasted money. It's money invested in your future. Even if it didn't happen in your lifetime, you would be able to provide for your family next year and the year after with these kinds of things. So that would be my best suggestion, Stan. I'm sure you have some, too. And are we finished?
Remember what happened in New Orleans. People were waiting for the government to come in, and the government didn't come in. In fact, when they came in, they were more harmed than good. So yeah. Thanks so very much for being with us, Jerry.
It's my pleasure, Stan.
Good night.
God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're trying to get, hopefully many of our listeners will begin making preparations for the difficult times which we feel do lie ahead. And so, certainly Jerry is an excellent source of information. Her website, arcinstitute.com, that's arcinstitute.com, and you can actually get certain things there from that website free of charge. Various books will actually tell you what to do if somebody in your family does come down ill. And if we were to see something of the magnitude we're talking about, you could see a total breakdown in the healthcare delivery system. Prepared to look after yourself and your family. And this is the time when we need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty, my ministry, is primarily listener-supported. And if you're out there and listening to us, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Now, you can go to our website at radioliberty.com, and you can pull down our programs there, directly or indirectly, 5 hours a day. There are many programs that are archived, and software to pull that down is readily available. Then, of course, we hope that you'll read our newsletters, because our newsletters deal with so much of what's going on today. It's very difficult to understand what's taking place unless you understand the spirits of forces that are at work behind the scenes. And we have a number of newsletters there on the occult hierarchy that rules the world. That would be my two newsletters that were written earlier this year. I think it's May and June 2005 newsletters. Do you believe that there are secret societies? Do you, for instance, believe that the Masons are a powerful force in America, that five of our last 12 presidents were Masons and another was closely affiliated with Masonry, that six of our last 12 presidents came from the membership roles of the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Council on Foreign Relations came from a secret society that originated with Masonry, or that two of our last 12 presidents came from a secret society called Skull and Bones? And you really can't understand anything that's going on today unless you understand that there is another agenda out there that nobody ever talks about. And so we hope that you'll go to our website, pull down our newsletters, read those, and then look at the list of items that are available through Radio Liberty that will begin to help you understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield, a battle for the survival of Western civilization and for the souls of men. If you are listening to our program in the Middle West on the Here's Help Network, remember we do a program every Saturday there at 12:30. And, of course, we hope that you will tell other people about our program. And because the greatest thing that you could do for somebody else is to help them understand the true nature of what's going on. As you read Revelation 6:8, you'll find that they talk about the fourth of the seals. And they open the fourth seal and saw the rider on the pale horse. And, of course, Hades followed shortly behind, and power was given unto them to kill a quarter of the population of the world with famine and with the sword and with pestilence, which is disease. Could that really happen in our world? Do you think that we're moving into the latter days? Well, listen to our programs, evaluate for yourself, understand there really are demonic and satanic forces in the world. Pray for America, pray for revival, please pray for Radio Liberty. Remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because we have with us on the line Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief. Andrew, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan, as always.
Well, tell us what the major issues are, the major news items that we're not going to be hearing so much about from the controlled media. What are the things that you at World Affairs Brief are beginning to emphasize and watch closely?
Well, surprisingly, some of the biggest news issues that were reported on in the World Affairs Brief have been reported recently by the major news media. What we're specializing in this week is reporting on how they have spun these various stories. I'm going to talk a little bit about the rendition stories and the secret torture bases that the U.S. has been having in other countries. If we get a chance, we'll talk a little bit about some interesting revelations of Bob Woodward and a little bit more about the Watergate investigation. And then we'll hopefully get to some world politics about Europe and South America. So we've got a pretty full brief tonight.
Okay, well, go right ahead.
All right, well, let's start out talking a little bit about extraordinary rendition. This is it's turned into sort of a famous word that is used to mask the true meaning of it. It's kind of a code word which has slipped out and is being reported on now. It basically stands for authorized interrogations by the U.S. Most people are aware of the news that has come out about the various CIA flights back and forth to various countries in Europe, ferrying people back and forth between secret bases that are being held there, secret detention bases. So the U.S. is operating prisons in other countries, and a couple of stories have come out recently about various detainees there. One of the most important to come to light is about a German citizen named Khaled Al-Masri. What's interesting is that this story was actually posted by the Washington Post. And the story that they give details of a German citizen, this German citizen, who was seized in Europe.
And he was actually kidnapped off the streets, wasn't he, someplace?
That's right, exactly. He was kidnapped by the CIA. He was taken, he was beaten, he was drugged. Then he was taken to Afghanistan and held there in a secret prison for a full 5 months before they realized that they had actually taken the wrong person.
And so that actually, they finally admitted they'd gotten the wrong man.
Yes,
totally inept. Here's a man who's tortured. If they could do it to him, could they do it to anybody? Just take them off the streets of America and then torture them until they got some sort of a confession? Wouldn't be worth anything. People will say anything under torture. What sort of moral fabric is there? And even more disconcerting is, why is the Washington Post, which is part of the invisible government of the United States, what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness, why are they reporting these stories and exposing what's going on to the entire world? There has to be a reason that they want this information out. If it weren't, why, of course, we would never hear it. So pick up the story there, Andrew.
All right. Well, of course, after this broke and the major news media started to report on it, there was a great deal of scrambling and an attempt by people on both sides of the Atlantic to try to cover up what was going on. The story broke because this German citizen created a lawsuit against the U.S. over his mistreatment there. And
he's actually suing Donald Rumsfeld, isn't he?
That's right, exactly. So the Washington Post has sort of picked up on this, and it's creating quite a bit of flack against the Bush administration.
But Andrew, the thing is that why would they be putting this out? What this is doing is inflaming the anger, number one, of the people of Europe against the United States. Totally unjust, torturing an innocent man. And then making no effort to compensate for him. And then what is this doing to the people in the Muslim world? It's turning them against the United States today. So the only reason that we would popularize or let this information out, or, you know, otherwise they would totally block it out. But obviously they want the people in the rest of the world to know. And they even don't care whether the American people know. There has to be a purpose, because you do not get this article in the Washington Post, and you don't get the amount of coverage from the establishment media, and unless they have a plan. They know exactly what they're doing. They're three steps ahead of us.
That's exactly right, and that's the most important point about this, is that they are leaking this precisely to allow and to even encourage antagonism against the U.S. over issues that the U.S. is actually doing. What's most interesting about the Washington Post is reporting this is that they will give just enough detail, and it's very slick how this happens. They will give just enough detail to inflame all of the Europeans who read this article, most of the liberals here, and yet the details won't be sorted enough to actually explain how badly the torture has been at these detention centers, allowing for still continued U.S. support of the Bush administration.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Andrew is certainly agreeing that they're putting these leaks out for a specific purpose, to antagonize the rest of the world, the Muslim world, the European world. And yet, of course, here in America, we seem to take it, well, after all, boys will be boys. We've just got to do this to defend ourselves against the wicked Muslims, because he might have been a terrorist, so it's all right if you go ahead and torture them. And we have lost our moral foundation. America, a once great Christian nation, at least stood theoretically for doing the right thing and the moral thing. We no longer stand that way, either in the eyes of the rest of the world, and certainly not in the eyes of the American people. What's really frightening is so many Americans are willing to go along with this sort of torture. After all, probably he was a bad man anyway. After all, wasn't he a Muslim? And the fact that you'll see this attitude on the parts of American citizens makes you really wonder what's happened to the soul of our nation. Go ahead, Andrew.
Well, I'd like to point out a couple of the attempted arguments in favor of this rendition and torture methods that have been proposed, most particularly by Condoleezza Rice, as she has toured around back and forth to Europe and sort of go through a couple of the contradictions to what she says. For instance, the Washington Post reported about the attempt to quell this growing storm that is occurring in Europe over, well, justifiably so, over this news that the U.S. has been transporting these people and keeping them in Europe. And this is what she says. What she didn't say is that President Bush's political appointees have redefined Ms. Rice insisted that the U.S. government does not authorize or condone torture of detainees. Here's the Washington Post offers a supposed rebuttal of this, which is, what she didn't say is that President Bush's political political appointees have redefined the term torture so that it does not cover practices such as simulated drowning, mock execution, and cold cells that have long been considered abusive by authorities such as your State Department. Now, Grace, what the Washington Post is pointing out is very true, and it is a perfect example of what I'm talking about with the Washington Post supposedly breaking ranks with the establishment media and exposing this very dark of our government program, which is to take people outside of the U.S. and torture them in these respects. And yet, what they mention here are relatively minor forms of torture, and by mentioning fairly minor forms of torture when in fact there are multiple stories of much more worse forms of torture. I mean, what happened in Iraq, for instance, I don't think that these are unrelated cases. I think that what has happened previously in Iraq is the same kind of thing that is going on in detention centers all around the world. If people think that there's a major difference between what's happening or what happened in Iraq and what's happening in these detention centers, is deluding themselves. I mean, this is just part of the whole fabric of what's going on. And if the media really wanted to pin down these things, they would try to link these things together, which in anybody's logical approach to things would be obvious that there's a pattern going on here with some serious human rights violations with regard to torture in other countries.
And I think it's what's so important to understand, this is a CIA function. The CIA was instrumental in committing atrocities in Vietnam. Vietnam was really a CIA-controlled war. So is Iraq. There are CIA teams operating openly there. You read the stories, you go back and read about Abu Ghraib, and all of the people who were eventually convicted and sent to prison said, we were ordered to do these things by the CIA operatives who were there. But none of them were ever sent to prison. And there have been instances where they tortured people to death, and they killed an Iraqi general who'd committed no crime at all. He wasn't listed, you know, as a war criminal at all. They brought him in, and they suffocated him to death, beat him and suffocated him to death. And nobody was ever held responsible. But, you know, why should we be surprised at that? We saw that with the story of Jesse Tretidou here in the United States, who was a young man who was picked up by the federal agents, taken to a prison in Oklahoma City shortly after the Oklahoma City bombing, and beaten to death. Now, eventually, the family pursued this. They got a settlement over $1 million from the federal government. Not a word of that in the controlled media. So, if they could, and nobody, of course, was ever cited or indicted for murdering Jesse Tretidou, beating him to death in a federal detention facility in Oklahoma. How could they suppress that information? Very simply, they control the media. Why is the story about rendition getting out? Because they wanted to get out. And, of course, what is even more frightening, they never mentioned this is all being done by the Central Intelligence Agency, not by, you know, not by the average American, not by our military, but the Central Intelligence Agency, like James Bond, they have a license to kill or to torture or do whatever they want to. And the trouble is the CIA has been financing this whole Islamic terrorist movement since its inception. And now they're picking up the poor people who are foolish enough to get involved with the Islamic Jihad and torturing them. And yet, nobody ever holds the CIA responsible for financing this movement from its very beginning. And anybody who doubts that needs to get the book Dollars for Terror, written back in 1999, that pointed out the whole movement financed by the Saudis, by the Pakistanis, and by our own CIA. Why aren't they held responsible for creating this whole situation that now they're torturing people to get to expose the background behind it? Go ahead, Andrew.
That's right, and what you mentioned about I think you mentioned this a little bit back about the way that Europeans are involved with this. I can't remember exactly what you said, but I wanted to bring up the point that the European government has been complaining about this, and they present themselves as all in a huff about this information that is leaking out about how the CIA has been flying planes in and out of various European countries, and how there are multiple detention centers. Most specifically, there were a couple mentioned, or at least one in Romania and Poland, and in an effort to protect themselves, the European leaders are demanding more information from the U.S. They're setting up investigations, and yet, if you stand back and look at this, something doesn't quite make sense. The CIA has been operating hundreds of flights in and out of all of these countries. They've been operating them out of Italy, Spain, Germany. The U.S. has been using this Romanian base for multiple flights in and out, as well as for months, years. To think or to put the idea forward that the European states aren't knowledgeable about anything that's going on, and yet they allow all of these flights in and out without checking passengers, without checking baggage, without checking on any of these flights is ludicrous. That they are unknowingly helping the CIA with these things as they are trying to tell their European citizens. So what I'm trying to point out is,
go ahead.
Is that this is one of the areas that is being glossed over by the major news media.
I really think is what people need to understand is that we have our government. Then we have an invisible government, and part of that works with the CIA. It's not answerable to our elected officials at all, or to the people of the United States. And the intelligence agencies throughout the world work in concert one with the other. And, you know, the governments in England are just, or throughout Europe, are just incensed to know these things are going on. And yet it is their own intelligence agencies working with the CIA that is allowing the CIA to land their planes and not have to go through customs, not have to sit to demonstrate that they're caring, and all of this indignation is just show business for the public. Would that be a fair statement? Because they don't want the public to know that the intelligence agencies are all complicit in exactly the same process.
Exactly, and what's more, they don't want to allow it to be seen that, in fact, many of their internal police agencies are complicit with the CIA in these activities. In fact, in Britain, a British Member of Parliament, Andrew Tory, is a chairman of the All Parliamentary Group on Extraordinary Rendition, a group of people that's been put in charge of overseeing this investigation inside of Britain. And this fellow has talked with Democracy Now, and he says, you know, they've landed in the UK, they refuel, they go on, and people know that it's likely that people are going to be tortured. It strikes me that these actions must make us complicit in torture, and that therefore we have broken the convention against torture. And he's absolutely right. There's absolute complicity within all of these countries that will stand by unless these flights happen.
And yet, of course, this is being used to turn the world against the United States. We're all being manipulated, ladies and gentlemen, and I fear we're being manipulated in preparation for the coming war. And we'll have very, very few allies throughout the world when that takes place. Well, Andrew, go ahead and pick up the story there.
All right. Well, in light of these recent developments, several of the U.S. cronies over in the U.S. have tried to present defense of these actions. For instance, Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of the U.K., defended the U.S. treatment of terror suspects including this policy of rendition, saying that it was justified because it helped prevent future terrorist attacks. Now let's take a look at this a little bit closer. Where have we seen that the U.S. is using all of the information that it must be getting out of these terrorist suspects that it is taking to these various places to be tortured for supposed information? Where have we seen this information taken to trial to prosecute these people? We haven't seen the U.S. prosecuting these terrorist subjects. We haven't even seen the U.S. prosecute Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, who was the supposed mastermind of 9/11, that many people don't even remember this, but this was a big deal back in 2003 when they claimed that they had captured him. We have no idea where this man is. He could still be under Pakistani ISI control, which was supposedly how he was caught. He could be living it up somewhere in Pakistan for all.
And he could have been an American agent as well, because actually he trained right here in the United States. I think he was an engineer or something. So he had lived here in the United States, had trained in the United States. How do we know that he was really, not a double agent? And that we knew exactly what was going to happen before 9/11. Could that possibly be true? Why won't they bring him forward? Why won't they try him? Won't they try any of these key people? What are they concealing from the United States?
Exactly.
And what are they concealing from the American people?
And what's more is how amazing it is that none of this is talked about. I mean, the news media will declare openly how important it is that we've caught this person, and then the entire story will die down and go completely flat, and no more talk will be about where he went, what happened to him, what's the information on it. It'll just die, and everybody just stops talking about him, and the entire issue just goes away.
Well, he should be tried. He should be tried and convicted and executed if he was really the man behind the 9/11 attack. So why won't they bring him forward and put him on trial and indict him and convict him? What are they concealing from the American people having to do with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? Because he was not only the mastermind behind the first World Trade Center, the second World Trade Center bombing, he was certainly working on the first World Trade Center bombing as well. So if he's really this vicious person who hates America, let's bring him forward, let's try him. And yet they've had him for a couple of years. They won't indict him. What are they covering up? This is the question that plagues me. Does it plague you as well, Andrew?
It does, but more so is the question about if this extraordinary rendition is a morally justifiable means of getting information from people. Why is this information not being used in normal courts of law, and why isn't it being used in bringing people forward and presenting evidence?
Well, that's all right there. Well, Andrew brings it for us. You know, if all this material that they're getting from rendition and torture is so viable, why won't they, of course, bring it forward, pick up the people that they're getting information on, and try them in courts of law? How many trials have we had here in the United States? They still have never tried Zacharias Moussaoui, the 20th bomber. They tried to actually convict some Islamic professor down in Florida. When the jury heard the evidence, they had a hung jury. They wouldn't convict him. They felt the charges and the charges against him were not adequate at all. Where are all the people being put on trial because all of this evidence we're getting from torture that's saving the lives of American citizens and of European citizens, and there isn't any. Go ahead.
That's right. As the Guardian quoted Condoleezza Rice as stating that rendition was necessary in instances where local governments did not have the capacity to prosecute a terrorist suspect. Now, this sounds good, but this argument makes no sense. It falls on its face. If the assumption is that the purpose of rendition is to gain information, why are we sending people to other places outside outside of this country where things can be done to them that cannot be done in the United States. Rendition doesn't become a tool in the war against terror and that people are being sent to where they can be interrogated harshly. This is a supposedly defense of this, and yet it simply underlines exactly how bad this this must be, what's going on out there if it can't take place in the United States itself.
And what about the Christian morality of our nation? America was once the beacon on the hill, the city on the hill, a Christian nation that everybody looked to as a moral nation. What about today? What do you think the attitude of people throughout the world is today? George Bush's current administration is doing more to discredit Christianity throughout the world than anything else I can ever remember during my lifetime.
And yet that's what's absolutely amazing, is that there are so many supporters of President Bush who still actually fit the mold of being good Christian people who are thinking that they are supporting this image of the city on the hill that is out trying to protect liberty. And yet every people all across the world have at the same time the exact opposite point of view that is being put forth by the press, the world press, and people are seeing this completely negative view of the U.S., which is certain points of certain parts of the dark side of government that are kind of eking out of the clouds and revealing themselves. These are the things that the rest of the world sees, and here in America, the people that form the good-hearted core constituency of good people in the U.S. often only get to see the cloud, the nebulous around it that kind of cloaks it and kind of paints it into a better light than what it really is by concealing facts and presenting facts in a slightly changed form or putting them down or just not talking about them. And that this then puts people to sleep here and inflames the rest of the world against us. And by putting people to sleep here, allows the globalist government and the Bush government, which is current right now, to continue this antagonism against the rest of the world with the full support of some of the best people in this country itself. And it's just absolutely amazing to see this unfold and to create so much antagonism with so much good-hearted people. It's quite frustrating to watch.
I think that there is a spiritual blindness out there that is blinding a lot of good Christians. They honestly think that we're protecting the country by torturing these people because they're revealing secrets and they're revealing plots that are, you know, that if were carried out would tend to undermine our country. The question is, well, if we've uncovered so many plots, why won't we tell the American people where they are? Why won't we bring the criminals involved in this to justice? And, oh, we can't do that. Osama bin Laden might find out. So everything is classified and top secret because we wouldn't want the wicked Osama bin Laden to find out what we knew about his plots to destroy America and undermine the fabric of our society. In fact, that's one reason we ought to ask is, why won't we ever try to get Osama bin Laden? We went to war with Afghanistan in October of 2001 to capture the wicked Osama bin Laden. The president promised to bring him back dead or alive. 4 years have passed. When was the last time you heard anybody talking about getting Osama bin Laden? Why won't the president demand that we get Osama bin Laden? If you read my latest newsletter, Porter Goss says he has a very good idea exactly where Osama bin Laden is, but of course we can't go after him for diplomatic reasons. Well, this Dr. Stan and Andrew, pick up the story there.
All right. Well, I've just about talked about the major points I'd like to get out of the story as sort of a last indication of this. I'd like to point out one thing that Condoleezza Rice stated as she was supposedly giving a detailed explanation about what happened. And this is classic of what happens when the Bush administration, or most of the time when the government is trying to cover up for its previous action. It says, all right, well, here, we'll spell it all out. This is what we've been doing. And they give a statement like this. They say that the Bush administration's most comprehensive accounting is that cruel and degrading interrogation methods are off limits for all U.S. personnel at home and abroad. And yet, she neglects to go into any of the details by giving specific examples of what the banned practices include, by not defining what cruelty or degradation means, by not saying if the rules would apply to private contractors or foreign interrogators, which, if anyone has listened to any of the stories or read any of the stories in World Affairs brief previously, some of the most egregious things that have happened in Iraq were undertaken by private contractors or foreign interrogators.
Private contractors were paying, of course, hired by the CIA to carry out these horrible and heinous deeds.
That's right, with under-the-table contracts and insider dealing with government officials. And, most importantly, she didn't make mention of what would entail any exceptions to this rule. And so a person can stand up in front of a group of reporters and give a blatantly generality of a statement like this and not get pinned down by reporters about the specifics of this. I don't think that reporters are just being dumb and not pressing them on these issues. We've seen occasions where reporters know how to drill things home and pin people down, and yet they give this kind of softball treatment to these high-level government people, and I think it shows complete complicity on the part of the major media groups with what's going on with the government.
All right, hang on, though. We'll be back in just a moment with Andrew Skousen here at Radio Liberty. Well, Andrew Skousen is just saying that the reporters over and over again will let Condoleezza Rice or the press representatives, press secretary of the administration, get up and frankly lie to them. And they will not ask the significant questions. They will not grill these people. They simply give them softball questions and they let them get away with it, because the reporters know that if they really press these issues, they're going to lose their jobs. They're not going to be allowed to come to press conferences. That will be the end of their career. So rather than do what they should do as members of the Fourth Estate, they simply nod and say, thank you so much, Ms. Condoleezza Rice, for clarifying all these issues, or whoever it may be. They let them off time and again, rather than ask the probing questions like, you see that there is no torture, that you do not use cruel, unusual, or degrading treatment of prisoners. So why is the president objecting to the Senate legislation the past 90-9 that outlawed cruel, degrading, and inhumane treatment? If you're not doing it, why do you object to a law that says you can't do it? And, of course, the president doesn't answer that. And you're seeing really Clinton-esque type of response with, certainly Bill Clinton would make the remarks, I am not having sex with that woman. Or, we have to define what the meaning of the word is when we're discussing what I really said. And what does the word is mean? Or what is the meaning of the word is? So basically they beat around the bush and they frankly lie. And the American people don't want to admit that they're lying, because we want to support our government and we want to believe that they're protecting us. And so an awful lot of good, well-meaning people, be Christian or non-Christian, are supporting this so-called just war that is being fought to protect our freedom here at home, whereas step by step they're taking our freedom away from us.
That's exactly right, Dr. Tan. That's a very good summary of things. I think that in some of the other stories that are in the World Affairs Brief this week, there's an indication of what is happening in other countries that our country is on the same path towards. And we can sort of see what would happen if this trend here in the United States continues by looking at where other countries are at in their various stages of government corruption and scandal and being caught up in the throes of socialism and benefit corrupted taxpayers and voters. For instance, if I can change gears, I'd like to talk a little bit about what is happening in the European Union recently.
All right, go ahead.
Mostly because it gives a very interesting point of view about what happens when the globalist insiders try to hold together multiple countries that all have various different pet groups that receive large groups of government subsidies. And of course the money that goes towards these subsidies has to come from somewhere, and in the case of the European Union, they're trying to work out budget crises now between all of the various different countries. And each country, when it joined the European Union, came in with all of their own government systems, with their own economic policies, with their own pet groups that were receiving benefits from the government, and nobody wants to give up their benefits.
Now, because you're talking now about the farmers, they want their subsidies. Some of the industrialists want special consideration and tariffs to protect them. So there's so many groups over there, each one wanting to protect themselves, that they're putting pressure on the government not to have this free trade that they supposedly was the very essence of the European Union.
Correct. And the budget is flailing right now because there's just not enough money to go around. Initially, to get the United Kingdom sort of on board with this, they had to offer to England that since England had a smaller percentage of farmers, that they wouldn't have to support as much of the entire farm subsidies. And what has happened now is on the other side of the channel, the French farmers, which receive a great deal of this. In fact, almost half of European Union spending goes to a common agricultural policy, a good portion of which goes towards these French farmers, which are used to receiving these doles and these benefits to keep their farm going. And they're having a hard time getting anyone to give up to even meet halfway. Recently, Tony Blair, who is the current EU president, tried to get EU leaders to agree on some kind of a budget for the span of 2007 to 2013. But the negotiations over the budget came completely derailed in June, largely over this issue about whether or not they were going to be able to meet the budget by cutting back on some of these subsidies. Britain tried to come halfway by offering to put more money into this general fund. They have a sort of a large rebate which was secured in 1984 by Margaret Thatcher, and Blair has promised that he would never negotiate this rebate away, which is of course a bit very important towards the solubility of the English economy. And now he has put a portion of this on the table in an effort to try to get these budget talks on the way. And yet the French farmers still refuse to give up any of their subsidies. And it illustrates this fact that benefit-corrupted people never vote away their benefits. Nobody will voluntarily give up these things that the government is forcibly taking from others and giving to them. And very few politicians have the, it's political suicide to give up or to take away people's benefits. They'll immediately vote you off. But that is the only way to actually get rid of these things, is to have the politicians forcibly stop them and take them away. And yet, this struggle is going on inside of the EU right now. And it's most interesting to see, because it highlights a difficulty that the globalists are having in trying to keep all of these nations together, because of their various socialist tendencies are kind of fighting against themselves here, and it's creating this sort of bickering back and forth, and it's actually undermining the overall globalist ideals here. And what is most interesting about this is that there are two sort of prognoses about how the globalist insiders are trying to get the world to edge further and further towards a unilateral government. One side says that it can only happen through war, and the other side says, well, war isn't necessary. Look at how it's happening now. I mean, we're edging step by step closer and closer to this. Look at the EU. Most of these nations have given up a great deal of their national sovereignty and are tending towards a unilateral government there. And yet, what is interesting is that without war to galvanize people, sort of in one group and make them give up sort of this bickering, the globalist advances tend to get halted and mired down in these same kinds of talks, which is why here at the World Affairs Brief we think that in the future it's probably going to happen, that there's going to be a major world war, which is going to make people want to give up any of their rights, including national sovereignty, just to be able to attempt to try to get some kind of world peace. And at that time, all of our rights will be taken away, and they'll never be given back again.
And that was really the purpose of World War One. Remember, that was the war to make the world safe for democracy, the war to end all wars. It was never intended to be that. It was to bring about the world government, the League of Nations. When that failed, they had to get a second world war going to bring about the United Nations. And still, people don't want to give up their national sovereignty. That's why there will have to be a third world war. And this has been planned for a long period of time. In fact, my friend Dr. Dennis Cuddy has provided me with a map that was drawn up in 1950, saying where at the end, when this whole thing was coming together, where the troops of the various nations would be stationed, and where do you think the American troops would be stationed? Why, right there in the Middle East where we are today. And this is what's going to precipitate World War III. Whether it'll be an attack on Syria, whether it'll be an attack on Iran, it doesn't matter. They'll precipitate whatever they want to. And then, of course, some way or other, why I fear that this will spill over into America. I think it will spill over into Europe. And you will see the greatest carnage in all recorded history. People say this could never happen. And I would ask, why couldn't it happen? And if God is just, why wouldn't he allow it to happen? So pick up the story there, Andrew.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And it's very interesting to live in this age and sort of watch the various pieces fall into place. A couple of things still have to happen. I think you're right that the tinderbox historically has been in the Middle East to start these world wars, and will continue to be the case in this next one. This tension that is sort of slowly simmering about Iran developing nuclear potential tends to indicate that that might very well be the final spark if Iran does continue to develop it and flaunt and thumb its nose, could give just enough of an established position that either Israel alone or Israel in combination with the U.S. could actually preemptively strike Iran with using nuclear weapons.
And if we do, of course, we've established the precedent, it would be perfectly all right to have a preemptive strike against the United States. How could we object to that when we've established that preemptive war is perfectly acceptable?
Right. But the retaliation towards that of the major world powers, China and Russia, responding with a nuclear strike against the U.S. would be difficult to carry out unless there was, at that time, a great deal of antagonism built up towards the U.S. So that's the sort of the other piece of the puzzle that more and more we start to see falling into place. It has to get to the point where if someone were to take down the entire U.S. military, the major U.S. structure, that the world at large would be happy and gleeful that they finally take down this overpowering, overburdensome, infiltrating U.S. System that everyone's been under the thumb of for so many years. And that is increasingly the image that the U.S. is creating among the rest of the world, and particularly among the Muslim people.
And of course, our president said, well, we don't want an empire. We have no reason to have an empire. Then, if we don't have an empire, why do we have troops stationed in 130 nations throughout the world? Why are we still occupying Europe 60 years after the Second World War ended, still occupying Japan 60 years after the Second World War ended? Why are we still occupying Korea 50 years after the Korean War ended? Why do we have troops stationed all throughout the Middle East and in South America? We've opened bases in Paraguay, and many people in Paraguay and throughout South America are convinced we're going to launch an attack, a war against Hugo Chavez. If we aren't having to have an empire, why are we forcing other nations to do exactly what we want them to do? And why are we replacing existing rulers with people who go along with our agenda? And this is what's happening in country after country throughout the world. And we are actually contributing money for political action in other nations. If somebody was contributing money to influence our elections, wouldn't we be incensed? And if we've done that in Ukraine, and we've done that in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Azerbaijan, why is it all right for us to try to influence elections in other nations, but not for other nations to try to influence elections in the United States? Go ahead, Andrew.
That's right, and that's exactly what is creating this antagonism throughout all of these other countries. It's not that people hate our liberties or hate the goodness that America stands for. They hate how we go through and infiltrate other people's governments and twist their arms behind their backs and jab them and point them and yank them around with our world loans and the IMF and use these various leverages to manipulate them in underhanded ways and behind their backs, behind the curtains, without everyone being able to see it. All of their leaders know very well throughout all of the countries that the U.S. is there to control and to get their own way with things. And this creates a lot of, this is the core issue of antagonism that is occurring throughout the U.S., throughout the world, and gets passed down from the leaders all the way down through to some of the lowest levels of societies around the world, and creates the antagonism that is happening today that we see now against the U.S.
I agree with you totally, and I think that every citizen should be deeply concerned about what's going on in the world. And realize, I believe we're moving towards World War III. Everything points in that direction. And I think this has been planned for a very, very long time. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Andrew Skousen to wrap up the program. Andrew, what's your telephone number?
The telephone number for the World Affairs Brief is 1-888-518-5888.
One more time.
Okay, well, that's toll free, 1-888-518-5888.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest this evening, Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and certainly I go to World Affairs Brief every morning to pull down their articles. If you really want to have insight into what's going on in the world today, you need to go to their website, and then, of course, we take the weekly summary of the events written by Andrew's dad, Joel Skousen, to give us an overview and a reinterpreting of what's going to happen. Well, you've got about 2.5 minutes to wrap up the program.
All right. Well, I'd like to briefly mention a little bit about what I was speaking about before. My father, Joel Skousen, has been traveling abroad, and he's had some very interesting insights down in South America. Many of us here in the States don't really pay attention to what's going on in South America, and yet what is happening down there, it's sort of indicative of the general sentiments of most of the rest of the countries throughout the world. What is most interesting to note is what is happening in Venezuela. Hugo Chavez is one of the most vehement anti-American presidents of any country around, or at least openly so. And he is using the natural resources of Venezuela's oil to try to break the various holds that America has down on South America, and he is doing it by getting together with some of the other presidents, and it illustrates how America tries to maneuver behind the backs and control the various presidencies. For instance, in the Argentine president, Kirchner, recently joined up with Venezuela's Chavez in an effort to try to loosen some of the attachment to the U.S., and he switched a large portion of his national debt to Chavez's Venezuela, so Chavez bought the debt for an 8% loan, and this country, Argentina, gave up a 4% loan.
But that was for the International Monetary Fund, which we control, and Argentina wanted to be independent of America.
That's right. And that is how deeply the anti-U.S. sentiment is down there, that they will give up a 4% loan through the IMF in order to gain an 8% loan with somebody else down there in South America. And they are currently trying to undermine Bush's FTAA plan, which is the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which is an attempt to...
Hold that thought right there, Andrew.
All right.
Well, our guest this evening is Andrew Skousen. Andrew Skousen was commenting that his father's traveling in South America, and people really don't understand what's happening down there. Hugo Chavez, who is violently anti-American and certainly very pro-communist, and much of what he's doing is rallying the people of Central America under his leadership. Argentina has recently borrowed money from Hugo Chavez at 8%, giving up a loan that they had with the International Monetary Fund for 4%. In other words, they've doubled the interest they're going to be paying, but they want to get out from under American control. There's a growing anti-American sentiment all throughout South America because of American policy and a growing hatred towards America. So pick up, we're just about done. Why don't you just sort of tie up things here before we let you go, Andrew?
Okay. I just like to mention that one of the portions of this is a trade bloc called Mercosur, which is composed of Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, Paraguay, all trying to group together to break the hold in direct opposition to the FTAA that Bush is trying to incorporate. So we see a lot of countries trying to get out from underneath the hold and the infiltration of the U.S. on things. And this is because of the anti-U.S. sentiment that our own government is creating by their attempts to influence things and control things in other countries.
And with our major foreign policy stripped of all of its idealism and compassion for the average individual, it is really to increase the poverty, to increase the power of authoritarian governments over the individual, and of course really to grind these people down under our control. Thank you very much for being with us, Andrew. It's always great to have you as a guest.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
I appreciate being with you. Bye.
Okay, that was Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief, but let me simply point out that there are some wicked people in Washington, D.C. I happen to love America, and I wish America represented what it used to represent, but unfortunately it doesn't. Those of you who have not read John Perkins' book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and John Perkins was part and parcel of this imperialistic program, and after 20 years after he left it, he wrote a book at the risk of his own life to try to tell the American people about what was going on and how the CIA, he called them the jackals, was actually actively killing world leaders, the president of Panama, the president of Ecuador, I think it was, and they actually arranged their murder as murders of other world leaders who did not go along with the American agenda. We have a four-tape set called Economic Hitman, which are my interviews with John Perkins. You need to find out about this information. It's not like you don't like to think bad things about your country if you love it as I do, but you have to understand that there are wicked people who have taken hold of the reins of power. And behind that are dark spiritual forces, which is what everybody who discusses these things has missed. And that is the spiritual forces which are guiding the course of events in the world today. So go to our website of RadioLiberty.com, that's RadioLiberty.com, and get the information that's readily available there, and then please pray for America. Pray for revival, because if we don't turn back to God, God is going to abandon America. And I tremble when I reflect at what's going to happen to this nation. And finally, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until we're together again, Dr. Stan Goodnight, and may the Lord be with you.